and oaths of loyalty to maintain order. In 1600, having returned to the north to defeat the Mac for good, Nguyen Huang acquiesced to the Trin ascendancy, pledged loyalty to the Lay Emperor, and then returned to the south. While he did not know it at the time, he and his family would go on to build a second Vietnam along the imperial frontier. By all accounts, Nguyen Huang appreciated the beauty of the land he encountered in the south, was seduced by its exoticism, and attracted by the riches it promised to the hard-working soul. The bustling port of Hoi An, its vibrant trade with the Indian Ocean, and the mosaic of local, regional, and international travelers, merchants, and missionaries impressed him. Chinese, Arabs, Persians, Japanese, and Europeans had long visited this ancient trading town the Vietnamese had taken from the Cham. As one eminent scholar has nicely put it, talent and ability began to count for more than birth and position. This was, in effect, an escape from ancestors, an escape from the past. For Nguyen Huang, the result was a greater reliance on his own abilities, a shifting of the burden of moral choice from the past to the present. This man and those putting their faith in him made something of a leap of faith, even if they maintained their ties to the North. They began to imagine a new way of being Vietnamese, a state of mind from which another southern polity could spring. These areas to the south of the Red River Delta were not, however, blank spaces. Millions of people lived in the lowland areas embracing the South Seas to the east, the highland massifs just to the west of Wei, and areas extending across the Mekong Delta to the Gulf of Thailand. Between 1000 BCE and 200 CE, an impressive Sa Huyn culture had thrived in present-day central and southern Vietnam, paralleling, even interacting, with its prehistoric counterpart to the north, the Dong Son civilization. Sa Huyn's craftsmen produced a wide variety of iron tools, weapons, and ornaments. The kingdoms of Funan and Chenla were the first to create loosely organized mandala-like polities in the Mekong Delta, 1 to 9 CE. Whereas the Viet in the north had borrowed Confucianism, Buddhism, and characters from China, the people of Funan in the south tailored Hinduism, Buddhism, and Sanskrit print culture coming from India to local needs. Thanks to the port of Ocao in the Mekong province of today's Anjiang province, Funan was the center of trade routes linking it to the Chinese and Indian Ocean empires. Other states subsequently emerged in this region. At its apogee in the 14th century, the Cambodian Empire of Angkor, based near the Tonle Sap, ruled large swathes of lower mainland Southeast Asia. Cambodian mastery of a sophisticated hydraulic system allowed for increased population growth, urbanization, and sophisticated political formations and extraordinary artistic and architectural achievements. For some, Angkorian civilization marked the largest complex of low-density urban development in the pre-industrial world, with a population of 1 million people. This vigorous empire certainly mobilized people, promoted Buddhism, and spread Pali and Sanskrit-based writing systems across areas located between the Chao Phraya and Mekong deltas. In areas north of the Mekong, centered around the port of Hoi An, the dynamic kingdoms of Champa emerged in the 7th century, mentioned in passing before and discussed in detail in Chapter 14. The Cham ruled territories running roughly from modern Ha Tin province south to Da Nang, including lowland and upland territories. Cham resources, markets, trade, and populations turned this coastal federation into a prosperous and culturally diverse land. Asian and Middle Eastern traders regularly visited this entrepot. Arab and Persian merchant ships had been trading along the Vietnamese coasts for centuries. These traders plying the Indian Ocean introduced Hinduism, Buddhism, and Islam to the Cham. Along the coast, Ming maritime movements triggered an early wave of Chinese immigrants to the region. And when the Ming ended their maritime expeditions in 1433 and focused their attention on Central Asia, the Japanese increasingly stepped in, while local southern Chinese merchants kept coming. Soon, European traders, adventurers, and missionaries were circulating throughout the region, introducing new ideas, products, weapons, and religions. Malay and Arab peoples called this region, bordered by China at one end and India at the other, the lands below the winds. The Chinese named it the Southern Seas, the Indians the Golden Peninsula, and the Europeans imagined the land beyond the Ganges before European geographers called it Indochina. Since the Second World War, we now refer to it as Southeast Asia. The Imperial State in a Southern Form. It was in these culturally diverse and populated lands that Nguyen Huang began building a new imperial state, a continuation of the earlier Lay one, but increasingly under autonomous Nguyen control. By the end of the 17th century, through the use of superior technology, force, persuasion, and an array of alliances, the Nguyen took over what remained of Champa, transforming it into the new province protectorate of Tuan Than. Much the same happened in the Mekong Delta as Nguyen lords extended their rule. Indeed, with the demise of Angkor in the 14th century, a new generation of Burmese, Thai, and Viet state builders all began moving southward into the fertile alluvial basins of the Irrawaddy, Chao Phraya, and Mekong rivers, attracted by the agricultural riches and the international trade. Armed with modern military technology, the Thais and the Nguyen rolled back the Khmer Empire in the 18th century and entered into close contact with each other for the first time in doing so. A range of factors pushed and pulled Viet settlers southward. Firstly, the Nguyen lords were military men, and the de facto government they crafted and administered was always a very martial one. Like the Lay, the Nguyen encouraged their soldiers sent in to conquer new territories to remain there at the head of military colonies. Their families could join them, and the Nguyen provided them with land to till upon demobilization. Tens of thousands of prisoners of war also ended up in the south. They provided indentured labor, but with good conduct, regained their liberty, land, and a new future in the south. To promote immigration, Nguyen lords also offered plots of land to poor peasants from the increasingly crowded Red River Delta. To help them, the Nguyen recruited Ming loyalists who had fled the Manchu conquest of China in 1644. Thousands of them sought refuge in Taiwan and the Mekong Delta. Around 3,000 Ming loyalists helped the Nguyen lords extend their political and economic control into the area of present-day Saigon, transforming it into the administrative region of Saigon's Ye Din in 1698. Further south, another Ming supporter, Mak Ku, turned the area of Ha Tien in the Gulf of Thailand into a prosperous and semi-autonomous realm. He ended up joining the Nguyen and helped them to incorporate this vibrant commercial and strategic area into their kingdom. These new colonies attracted more Chinese refugees, traders, and immigrants. Intermarriage was common, and their children, called Min Huang, or those who were loyal to the Ming, worked in the Nguyen civil service. That said, Nguyen colonization of the south did not occur overnight, in one military swoop, or in a single wave of settlers. Viet settlers trickled southward in slow, almost imperceptible movements over long periods of time. This meant that middle grounds emerged in conquered Cham and Cambodian lands. Hardly a majority at the outset, Viet immigrants had no choice but to live in Cham towns and villages with the local peoples. Writing in 1644, one Nguyen chronicler reported that areas around Hoi An are all settled by Chams, while the immigrants, Vietnamese, are still sparse. As in Jiaozi, intermarriage, collaboration, and borrowings between the settlers and the indigenous peoples were common. They frequented the same markets. The northern Dai Viet court had long borrowed from the Cham. Lowland Viet settlers and Chinese merchants traded with highlanders, such as the Jirai and Hri. If the Vietnamese spread their language, religious practices, and culture, many Viet settlers also adopted Cham agriculture technology, spiritual beliefs, food, and music. When expansion into these areas also necessitated flexibility and compromise, although violent conquest may have opened new lands and futures for Viet settlers, the Nguyen simply did not have enough soldiers to ensure security all the time and everywhere, or adequate numbers of bureaucrats to rule over such vast and far-flung regions, and they always had to keep a watchful eye on the Trinh to the north. The Nguyen did what so many colonizers do. They adopted indirect forms of colonial rule in the form of protectorates and military territories. They carefully maintained the pre-existing administrations and a collage of non-Viet elites through whom they administered these territories. They struck alliances through intermarriage, showered gifts on those who cooperated, and consciously appropriated Cham shrines, rituals, and deities if it helped them legitimate their rule and attract local support. Imperial expansion in Vietnam did not solve internal political competition among Vietnam's military houses, however. On the contrary, by the 18th century, a de facto independent Nguyen imperial polity had emerged in the south, quite different from the one in northern Vietnam from which it had sprung. Vietnamese now called this southern domain Dang Trong, the inner region, in contrast to Dang Nuoi, or the outer region, meaning the Trinh-run state of Dai Viet in the north. In theory, both regions constituted a greater Dai Viet unitary state, with the Trinh military house in charge and the Li Emperor serving as a symbol of continued dynastic unity. But the fiction of all of this could last for only so long, as the Nguyen kept building what was in practice a quite separate Dang Trong Empire state running southward from the Jian River to the Mekong Delta with its capital in Hue. In 1613, in his deathbed statement to his son, Nguyen Quang warned him that if an accord could not be struck with the Trinh, then you must strive to guard and protect our territories and await a suitable opportunity. Do not forget these, my commands. His descendants did not. In 1620, tensions came to a head between the long-divided military houses when the Nguyen refused to pay taxes to their Trinh masters in Hanoi. This act of fiscal defiance was in fact a declaration of political secession. Civil war followed in 1627, when the Trinh attacked the Nguyen headquarters in Hue. The northern Vietnamese organized 7 campaigns against the Nguyen. All of them were failures, with the last ending in 1672. Military stalemate ensued, leading to a century of relative calm as the Nguyen continued building another Vietnam. Indeed, as Nguyen Phuc Chu's invitation to Shilian Dashan, the Buddhist abbot, revealed, by the late 17th century, the Nguyen wanted their own state. Undeterred by Qing China's refusal to accord diplomatic recognition, Chu cast the first royal seal establishing a Nguyen monarchy in 1709. In 1744, his descendant mounted the newly created royal throne in Hue. This self-assurance confirmed what everyone knew since the start of the civil wars in 1627. 2 Dai Viets existed. What no one in Hanoi or Hue saw coming was a third force led by 3 rebel brothers who bolted out of the central Vietnamese highlands, rallied large armies to their cause, and in so doing upended a chronically fragile Vietnamese order. The Nguyen survived, barely, to return to power in 1802. The Trinh and the Lai did not. Civil War and 3 Vietnams, the Thay Son Rebellion. Starting in 1771, 3 angry brothers rode a wave of socio-economic discontent to power across Vietnam. In so doing, they renewed the simmering civil war between the Trinh and the Nguyen, sparked regional conflicts with the Thais and Chinese, forged unprecedented alliances with Khmers, Chams, and upland peoples, and drew Europeans into the fray for the first time. There had been signs for some time suggesting that all was not well. unable to establish accurate censuses in regions they administered badly or had only recently colonized, the Nguyen struggled to generate revenues. Foreign trade had declined notably in the 1750s, denying the dynasty one of its main sources of revenues. To compensate, leaders increased taxes to the point where they became onerous. These fiscal demands extended into the central highlands, spreading socio-economic discontent among non-Viet peoples. As in China, bimetallism exacerbated rural unrest in Nguyen, Vietnam. When Hue could no longer import copper from Chinese and Japanese mines to cast its coins, the Nguyen turned to a cheaper zinc substitute. Not only did they impose this cheaper money on the population for making transactions for rice, but they also demanded that it be accepted and exchanged at parity with copper cash. Unsurprisingly, peasants hoarded rice rather than selling it for depreciating zinc coins. The result was predictable. The overall rice supply available plummeted, prices rose, and hunger began to stalk the kingdom. At the same time, the court increased its demands on commercial farmers in the Mekong Delta to produce and send more rice northward. One of the regions hit hardest by these policies was in Quy Nhon, where the Tay Son Revolt started. Without well-staffed, trained, and sufficiently paid civil servants, the court was often blind to the anger spreading across the lowlands and into the hills. Faced with high taxes, Cham anti-colonialism resurfaced in the Quy Nhon area near their ancient capital. Underpaid local administrators in the highlands were often tempted by competing alliances, loyalties, and corruption. The teacher of the Tay Son brothers was a former Nguyen administrator with a grudge. He had been reprimanded and demoted by the court, unjustly so in his eyes. He was arguably the one who sparked the whole fire by urging his former pupils to revolt. What we do know is that in 1771, in a small village called Tay Son, located in the highlands looking down on the port of Quy Nhon, three Nguyen clan brothers, Nhạc, Lu, and Wei, launched a revolt against high taxes and corruption. It spread like wildfire as the Nguyen court scrambled to stop them by calling in the army. The Trinh were delighted to see their arch-rivals under siege and immediately dispatched their own troops to the Jiansong Pass to put down the rebellion in the name of a unified Dai Viet. In their rush, however, the Trinh forgot their own problems in the Red River, not least of all, recurrent bouts of severe famine and equally destabilizing revolts. Pragmatic, the Tay Son signed a truce with the Trinh to keep them at arm's length in Wei while the brothers focused their attention on wiping out the Nguyen heading southward into the Mekong Delta. The Trinh accepted. They preferred to let the Tay Son destroy the Nguyen so that they could tend to their own problems in the north, confident that they could deal with the Tay Son brothers later. The brothers thus pressed on, forcing Nguyen troops to flee to the Gia Dinh Saigon region and as far as Bangkok. Fighting went on back and forth in the Mekong Delta and the Gulf of Thailand. In a near-fatal blow in 1777, the Tay Son killed a Nguyen monarch and much of his family holed up in the Saigon area. 5 years later, the Tay Son massacred some 10,000 Chinese there for supporting the newly crowned prince, Nguyen Phuc An, the future emperor Xialong, who barely escaped into the Gulf of Thailand and on to Bangkok. Reassured by their military victories, the Tay Son brothers grew ever bolder, so much so that in 1778, Nhạc proclaimed himself ruler of the Nguyen kingdom. Significantly, he chose as his new capital the Cham city of Vijaya, near Quy Nhon. From this point on in time, there existed three political centers for Vietnam, that of the Tay Son based in Vijaya, the surviving Nguyen holed up in the Mekong Delta, and the Trinh in Hanoi. They all paid lip service to the powerless lay emperor, whose only real function was to reassure the Chinese that the lay were still there, and to serve as a symbol of a mythic Dai Viet unity which everyone knew to be a sham. Having repelled a Thai attack in 1785, the Thé Son brothers finally set their sights on Hanoi. After routing the Trinh army, Nguyen Wei marched victoriously into the Red River in 1786. Here, too, famine, recession, corruption, and divided loyalties created conditions that helped this Thé Son brother vanquish the second military house of Dai Viet. In 1788, Nguyen Wei declared himself emperor of Dai Viet, adopting the reign name of Quang Trung and doing away with the Lê dynasty. This was too much for the Chinese, who maintained a tributary relationship holding them to protect the Lê imperial house. When a Qing army entered the Red River Delta to restore the Lê, war immediately followed. In a historic victory celebrated to this day, Quang Trung expelled the Chinese and ruled Dai Viet from Hanoi until his death in 1792. As historic as it was, Thé Son rule did not survive its new emperor. The loss of the dynamic and the militarily gifted Quang Trung, as well as infighting within the Thé Son entourage, sapped morale and undermined effective governance. Personal rivalries and territorial fragmentation were such that it is impossible to speak of a truly unified Thé Son Vietnam between 1788 and 1792. The brothers fell back on pre-existing ingrained patterns of military rule under the guise of monarchy and tended to divvy up the country into regional fiefdoms. They also had a formidable foe in the person of Gia Long, who brought the Nguyen state back from the brink of extinction. Tenacious, this young man had carefully bided his time, building up an impressive array of local and international alliances. Charismatic, he forged close relationships with southern strongmen, religious leaders, the Chinese community, and non-Viet groups. He promised them considerable autonomy and privileges in the post-war era in exchange for their collaboration. He outdid all of his rivals in securing diplomatic and military aid from an array of Asian and European governments, merchants, arms dealers, missionaries, and the like. By the time the Thé Son revolt was running out of steam in the north, Gia Long had assembled an army and navy in the south that rolled its way northward to crush the house of Thé Son for good. In many ways, the Thé Son revolts remind us of the Taiping Rebellion that would roar out of southern China in the mid-19th century. Like the leaders of the Kingdom of Great Peace in China, though on a much smaller scale, the Thé Son brothers rode a massive wave of popular discontent, forged pragmatic alliances with non-Viet populations, tapped into religious networks, and worked the social margins of bandits and criminals with great success. Their millenarian promises of a better future attracted massive support. While they disappeared in 1801 as rapidly as they had appeared 3 decades earlier, the social fury they unleashed and the shattering of political sovereignties they left behind were as transformative as that which the Taiping achieved in China. By marching from one end of Vietnam to the other, the Thé Son opened the way to a wider and southern-dominated unitary state, which Gia Long assumed upon his final victory over the Thé Son in 1802. As a high-ranking Nguyen official put it accurately in 1806, "It is true that in our country of Viet, from ancient times to the present, this territory had never before been as broad and vast as this." This is how modern Vietnam acquired its current S-like form. But that unity came at a high price, as it would in the 20th century. In a dirge for the fallen Civil War soldiers, Nguyen Du, one of Vietnam's greatest poets, captured the suffering caused by 30 years of death and destruction. He spoke of the young who had gallantly ridden off to fight, but who died without children to tend to their souls. "There were proud men who followed glory's path. They warred and hoped to conquer all the world. Why talk about the heyday of their might? Remember their decline, their fall, and grieve. Killed young, they've left no heirs. They drift unmourned as headless ghosts that moan on nights of rain. Defeat or triumph lies in heaven's scheme. Will ever those lost souls escape their fate? Chapter 2. A Divided House and a French Imperial Meridian? Jialong's successors, Emperors Ming Mang and Tiao Tri, followed international events closely as they each tried to bring a long-divided Vietnam under control during their respective reigns. Ming Mang, reign 1820-41, Tiao Tri, reign 1841-7. Between 1823 and 1846, the Nguyen court dispatched at least 20 official delegations to island Southeast Asia, what the Vietnamese called the Southern Lands, to gather information. Others went to China. Emperor Ming Mang put some of the best and brightest in charge of these fact-finding missions and could even make exceptions for those who had been on the wrong side of his family's victory in 1802. The pro-Taysan ties of Phan Huy Chu's family did not prevent him from leading an important mission to China in 1831 and another one to Indonesia in 1832. A decade later, another northern emissary with a less-than-perfect resume, Cao Bai Khat, left for the southern lands on a similar fact-finding mission. With the Opium War underway, the latter provided a detailed and alarmist account of the western threat. The British Red Hairs, he warned, were now expanding their colonial control and naval power from Singapore to Hong Kong. The Nguyen rulers read these reports closely, questioned their advisers carefully, and pondered what the expansion of Western power in Asia could mean for their country. Internally, Ming Mang ruled with an iron fist, convinced that it was the only way to bring order to this Vietnam that had never existed before. He respected his father, but the inefficiencies of the empire he had inherited exasperated him, and he dedicated his reign to fixing them. As his ambassadors traveled abroad, the emperor embarked upon one of the most audacious and far-reaching state-building projects since the Lei dynasty in the 15th century. This meant transforming what remained a very militarized polity into a Confucian-structured civilian government. It meant bringing into line many Lei, Trinh, and Taysan partisans who had never really accepted the Nguyen victory of 1802. It meant assimilating and civilizing non-Viet peoples, and it meant taming this unruly spiritual world that had moved south with centuries of colonial expansion and transformed into something quite unique as it connected with Cham, Khmer, maritime, river, and highland spirits. Revolutions always come with a price, however, especially when they occur at unpredictable international conjunctures. Ming Mang's was no exception. Upon his death in 1841, he left behind a deeply fractured country that his successors did not have the time to heal. In 1854, just a few years before the French attacked, Cao Ba Khat died leading a rebellion against the court he had served. Then Le Duy Fang, an angry Catholic with the restoration of the Lei on his mind and hungry peasants in his ranks, asked the French for help. While the French turned him down and the Vietnamese emperor had him executed, Vietnam remained a very divided house as Europeans began to move menacingly into the Southern Sea. Holding it together. Vietnam under Jialong. When Nguyen Phuc An adopted the name of Jialong and declared himself emperor of a new unprecedented Vietnamese unitary state in 1802, he was deeply aware of the fragility of this new political entity and the explosive tensions that could still tear it apart. Unlike his counterparts in Thailand and Burma, who had also emerged victorious after decades of civil war in the 18th century, Jialong stepped more lightly when it came to imposing central control. During his reign between 1802 and 1820, he maintained many of the flexible, moderate, and pragmatic wartime policies that had enabled him to take all of Vietnam. He allowed the Cham to keep their protectorate status and king, the larger Khmer populations continued to practice Theravada Buddhism, speak their language, and run local affairs without molestation. The Chinese in Saigon Yading, who had suffered greatly during the Civil War, prospered under the victorious Nguyen Emperor they had supported, as did the Catholic missions. That said, Ya Long knew he had to establish some sort of order and consolidate a lasting hold on this new Vietnam, the northern part of which his family had never ruled. In the early years, he did what any victor does. He left his occupying army and officers in charge of maintaining order until he could bring in his own people, determine who in the Ancien Regime could be trusted, and figure out more generally what would be the best model for building a new state. He maintained the Nguyen monarchy declared by his ancestors in 1744 and authorized the creation of a restoration myth to connect it to a timeless royalist tradition. Unlike the Li, Tran, and his own predecessors, however, Ya Long refused to elevate Buddhism to a national religion. Despite his time in Thailand and friendship with the Chakri Buddhist king there, the Vietnamese monarch never attempted to form a royalist alliance with the Buddhist church, its clergy, monasteries, and schools in order to centralize rule and push its power down to the grassroots, and he rejected out of hand suggestions that he should give Catholicism a try. More secular-minded, Ya Long turned to Confucianism and Chinese models of statecraft as the best way for bringing all of Vietnam under his family's rule. To this end, he issued a new law and penal code based closely on the Chinese model, defining correct social relations and laying out the nature of the state along Confucian lines. He restored a regional examination system that had fallen by the wayside during the war. New Confucian academies and schools reappeared across the land to train elites for government service. He dispatched envoys and diplomats to China, including the future author of The Tale of Qu, Nguyen Du, to study what the Chinese were doing and bring back texts and ideas that could be used in a Vietnamese context. In a bid to show his northern critics that the Nguyen were just as Confucian as their predecessors, he created an imperial capital in Wei worthy of its name by closely modeling it on the Chinese one in Beijing. But once again, theory and practice are two very different things. It was not because Ya Long chose Confucianism as his preferred political model that it became operational overnight. It did not. Ya Long was a military man and proud of it. He had never had the time himself to undergo any formal Confucian training in his youth, and probably never gave it any serious thought. He had built his reputation, his army, and his extraordinary victory in 1802 on pragmatism, personal initiative, deal-making, and the power of his word. Secondly, Ya Long knew just how fragile this new Vietnam born of 30 years of war was. The Trinh and Thay Son armies might have disbanded, but loyalties remained deeply divided. The wounds of war might have healed, but the scars remained. Hate and vengeance often lurked beneath the veneer of tranquility. The victorious emperor did not help when he tracked down all the remaining Thay Son leaders he held responsible for killing his family, and then killed what remained of theirs. Thirdly, Ya Long knew the political, military, and economic power of regional lords. His family was one of them, and he had helped a new group emerge from a wartime power base in the Mekong Delta. Indeed, Ye Long's longtime ally and dear friend in Yi Ding Saigon, General Li Van Duyet, effectively ruled the South after 1802. The emperor rewarded other wartime allies with high-ranking positions in the center and the north. This is why, despite issuing a new Confucian law code, resurrecting the civil service exams, and creating a capital with its own Chinese forbidden city, the emperor kept a very military regime in place on the ground. For central Vietnam, the court ruled through 4 military camps and 11 military provinces. For northern and southern Vietnam, the emperor administered 5 such provinces, respectively. During Ya Long's reign, military lords were as much a part of Vietnamese political culture as was the Confucian monarchy. This duality reached back to the rise of the Mac, the Trin, and the Nguyen houses in the 15th century, if not earlier. Nguyen political appointees thus tended to dominate the top positions in the post-war state, regardless of the outcomes of civil service exams. Many Lay, Trin, and Taesun civil servants and advisors withdrew, refusing to serve the new dynasty. But many stayed on out of necessity or conviction to create this unprecedented Vietnam. Such men included Nguyen Du, Phan Huy Chu, and Cao Ba Cat, and of course, Ya Long never had or trained enough officials to run the lower levels of the northern bureaucracy. He maintained pre-existing civil servants in place as long as they continued to do their jobs faithfully. But as Cao Ba Quat's revolt would show, Ya Long had to exercise great caution in this northern land where so many elites had served the Trin, the Lay, and even the Taesan. Indeed, former Taesan supporters had scattered all over central and northern Vietnam, running into the highlands. None of these groups necessarily saw 1802 as a definitive victory, nor did they subscribe to the new dynasty's restoration myth, which placed the Nguyen of Wei at the center of a seamless Vietnamese tradition they all knew to be patently false. Many considered the Lay, the Red River, and Hanoi to be the real repositories of Vietnamese identity, history, and culture. Loyalty thus remained a constant problem. Nguyen Du's Tale of Q tells the story of the tragic destiny of a heroine who sold herself into prostitution in order to save her family, but some also read it as a subversive reflection on the fate of those who had to serve a dynasty that was never really theirs, never truly legitimate. Rather than attacking all of these forces head-on and risking renewed civil war, Ya Long reformed rather than remade what remained a royalist military regime with Confucian characteristics. The new emperor did promote greater centralization and state control in other ways. He clamped down on all sorts of social and religious unrest. He presided over the creation of new roads, dikes, and canals in order to promote economic development and unity. The construction of the Mandarin Route, the precursor to today's Highway 1, reflected the Nguyen desire to connect the new Vietnam. By circulating administrators from north to south and vice versa, he sought to stitch the different Vietnams into one administrative body. A new postal service moved information, decrees, and reports across the land, as did the circulation of a standard currency. Ya Long continued military and civilian colonization programs as the best way of increasing agricultural production and relieving population pressures, but his state also cleared land and built dikes. Defense spending remained a priority. Between 1778 and 1819, the Nguyen state produced over 1,482 ships for war and trade, while several French-style Vauban fortresses went up along the Vietnamese coast. Minh Mang's Revolution? Ya Long's son, Minh Mang, was a very different type of leader. Born in 1791, he was too young to have remembered much of the Civil War, nor of the near extinction of the dynasty at the hands of the Taesan. While he certainly respected what his father and his allies had done, the new emperor was a firm believer in creating a strong civilian-run state instead of the military one he had inherited. He deplored this hybrid system in which failures were seen as achievements and nothing was seen as something. Minh Mang shared his father's view that a royal alliance with Buddhism was inoperable, and certainly not with Catholicism, which the young emperor seems to have despised from an early age. Trained in the classics, he saw Confucianism as the best political ideology for making Vietnam work, but only on the condition that he achieve what his father had been unable to do, dismantle the military state, eradicate local privileges and warlordism, terminate special rule for non-Viet peoples, subordinate religions, rituals, and their spirits to state control, and then Confucianize the state and society from top down. Rational to the point of obsession, intelligent like few before him, Ming Mang devoted his 20-year reign to creating a modern, centralized state. Ruthless, he would let nothing get in the way of that goal. Essential to getting this project off the ground was the reintroduction of the Confucian Ministerial Service, the Civil Service Examination System, and the selection of regional and provincial leaders based on merit, transparency, rotating assignments, and bureaucratic loyalty. In 1821, only a year after assuming the throne, the young emperor established provincial exams on a regular, triennial basis, and then opened the metropolitan exam in Wei to the best and brightest, regardless of their regional location or their family's past. In so doing, he sought in part to assuage northerners who resented his father's reliance on southerners and military men to run the Red River. He was also betting that the more Confucian-minded northern elite, both the Lei and Trin, would welcome the rebirth of the examination system, providing them with a stake in this new Vietnam and a reason to shift their loyalties to the Nguyen for good. Like the Lei, Ming Mang saw in Confucianism, its exams and the bureaucracy undergirding it, a powerful instrument for political integration and an administrative vehicle for diffusing the court-centered ideology to the lower levels, to local officials and villagers alike. Mirroring the Thai and Burmese rulers building modern states to the west, Ming Mang agreed that centralized authority turning on rational bureaucratic control could allow for more efficient economic development. Taxes on people and trade would provide the money needed to invest in major infrastructure projects, purchase foreign imports, and pay the salaries of the expanding civil service. Better bureaucratic control extending down to lower levels would allow for the mobilization of the large amounts of labor needed to build new dikes, roads, and bridges. The emperor also supported efforts to promote international trade. He knew that decades of war had allowed an illicit commerce to develop independently of state control. His father had benefited from this in wartime. The emperor accordingly cracked down on the smuggling of rice and opium, and in its place promoted state-run commerce with Singapore, China, and the West through approved Chinese, Vietnamese, and European merchants. The Nguyen organized the large Chinese trading community into congregations so as to better control and tax them. The sale of opium now went through a state-controlled Chinese monopoly. The expansion of European colonialism into the region reinforced this internal consolidation. Ming Mang knew that the Westerners arriving in the wake of Napoleon's defeat in Europe in 1815 were very different from the ones who had helped his father. In 1819, the British acquired Singapore as a colony and overseas base, while the Dutch expanded their direct hold over Indonesia's interior. In the mid-1820s, when the British extended their rule from India into Burma by force of arms, Ming Mang urged his Chakri counterpart to support the Burmese, rejecting the request of a Burmese delegation in Saigon seeking an alliance against the Thais. He dispatched dozens of missions into Asia, one reporting back from British Calcutta in 1830. The emperor always had an eye on the rapidly changing international situation. But what concerned him most was consolidating his hold over Vietnam. Ironically, the source of the greatest armed resistance to his revolutionary project was not in the foreign north, but in his own southern backyard from whence his father had conquered all of Vietnam and where he had been born. Upon taking the throne in Wei in 1802, Gia Long had left powerful military men in charge of the south. Foremost among them was Lai Van Duyệt, Gia Long's charismatic general, close friend, and godfather to Ming Mang. General Duyệt and his officers ruled the south for the Nguyen. Though fiercely loyal to their emperor, they also enjoyed considerable privileges in the southern delta, ruling over local fiefdoms and maintaining their own troops. Indeed, behind this southern general stood an array of other people and interests. They included Catholic missionaries, Chinese merchants, non-Viet peoples, local strongmen, and probably Buddhist millenarians too. Most of them had served Yalong during the Taishan Wars and appreciated the local autonomy they had received in return. Few of them were Confucians. In fact, the Confucian examination system could only get you so far in this part of the country, where deal-making and heterogeneity were a fact of life. But where General Duyet and his southern entourage saw this as politics as usual and never dreamed of revolting, Ming Mang began to see these people and their looser politics as an obstacle to the modernization, centralization, rationalization, and homogenization of the Vietnam he was determined to build. This is how Southern loyalty began to transform into Southern sedition and separation. Upon coming to the throne, the young emperor bided his time, but he let it be known that change was on its way, everywhere. In 1824, General Lê Văn Duyệt intimated to a friend during a trip to Hue to defend Catholic allies in trouble with the court and explain why the Vietnamese should forge an alliance with the Burmese, that the court recruits civil officials and wants to make a proper ruling system with them. Both of us have risen in the world from a military background. We only know straight expression and quick action, thus violating manners or official rules sometimes. We are originally different from them. We had better give up our positions to avoid possible mistakes. The two southern generals tendered their resignations, but Minh Mang wisely refused them. He waited until Duyệt died in mid-1832 before making his move in the south, although he had already begun dismantling the military government from Quang Binh upward. As he did so, he replaced it with a civilian-run system based on provinces and governors, with the court in charge and the civil service exams in operation. To those tempted by revolt, he sent a clear message that same year, ordering that the surviving male descendants of the Taishan brothers were to be arrested and executed, pour l'exemple. In 1833, with General Duyệt finally gone, the emperor decreed the abolition of the semi-autonomous southern military regime based in Saigon, Gia Dinh, and ordered its replacement with a civilian government ruling over six provinces with civil governors at the helm. The emperor now divided the kingdom of some 8 million people into 31 provinces and 283 districts, all falling under three regional administrative groupings: Nam Ki, south; Trung Ki, center; and Bac Ki, north. To mark the start of this revolutionary project, he changed the name of the country to Dai Nam, the land of the Greater South. This administrative transformation included the ideological unification of the civil service and society through the twin policies of cultivation, Yao Hoa, and Sino-Vietnamese acculturation, Han Phang Hoa. In 1834, the court promulgated the Ten Articles Edict, requiring mandarins to honor Confucian commandments such as filial piety, respect for elders, and moral obligations to the emperor. Civil servants received instructions to explain and apply these edicts at the village level as an instrument of social control. Minh Mang cracked down on heterodox religious beliefs and practices, especially but not exclusively in the Mekong Delta, where an astonishing mosaic of religions, millenarian movements, cultures, ethnic groups, and loyalties reigned. He countered these by promoting state-sponsored ancestor worship. To this end, the emperor presided over the creation of a vast network of temples, altars, shrines, indeed an entire pantheon of officially approved heroes, all of which sought to associate the local populations with the court. Minh Mang had no problems grafting this state religion onto local Cham and Buddhist spirits and deities if it reinforced the court's legitimacy and thus reached the people. But religion had to be under his state's control. Minh Mang reversed his father's indirect rule over non-Viet peoples. Viet civil servants increasingly assumed the administration of Khmer villages, ending centuries of protectorates and indirect rule. Land was surveyed and taxes applied to non-Viet peoples who had been exempted or lightly imposed upon in the past. Accompanying the establishment of direct rule over the Cham were the efforts made to assimilate all non-Viet peoples to a Sino-Vietnamese Han culture, the Vietnamese language, Chinese characters. In short, an inclusive Dai Nam identity defined from the capital from the top down as part of an East Asian Han civilization. The court required Khmer children in Wei to learn Vietnamese, use chopsticks, and wear Viet-style clothes. Pre-existing Khmer Theravada temples started to disappear as Sino-Vietnamese Mahayana pagodas appeared in their place. By advocating Han cultivation and acculturation, the Vietnamese emperor sought to legitimate local state-building and colonial assimilation. And when the Khmer rose up, Minh Mang smashed them just as he crushed the Cham, Catholics, or anyone else who defied, or even appeared to defy, his control over state power and ideology. Like the Lay in the 15th century, Minh Mang's internal state consolidation manifested itself externally in the form of aggressive colonial expansion. In 1835, the emperor terminated the vestigial political power of the Cham by formally incorporating Pandaranga into the Nguyen administration. In 1813, in response to the Cambodian king's request for help to dislodge the Thais, Gia Long had already dispatched General Le Van Duyet to Phnom Penh and placed Cambodia under a protectorate. But in the 1830s, Cambodia proper became a province of the Dai Nam Empire. Minh Mang's court dispatched Confucian-trained Viet governors and civil servants to administer provinces and districts throughout Cambodia. Wei authorities controlled military and economic affairs and applied there many of the same assimilationist policies used against the Khmer minority described before. The court levied taxes, issued orders to build roads, encouraged Viet and Chinese immigration westward, and even hoped to substitute Mahayana Buddhism for its Theravada version inside Cambodia. The Nguyen expanded control over areas in eastern Laos too, including Samno, Savannakhet, and Tran Ninh. By 1840, the Empire of Dai Nam already looked a lot like French Indochina. Imperial expansion and state consolidation often went hand in hand in modern Vietnam. Like his predecessors, Minh Mang justified the conquest of Cambodia on Han cultural grounds borrowed from the Chinese. Only superior Confucian culture and institutions could civilize the barbarian Khao Mien or Man Cambodians, he argued. As members of an East Asian Confucian world, the Vietnamese had a duty to introduce modern Sino-Vietnamese administrative institutions and civilization to Cambodia. The Nguyen would bring superior technology to better exploit the riches of this country, and long before the French had done so, the Vietnamese court had already portrayed the Khmers as lazy and disorganized. As Minh Mang explained the Vietnamese mission civilisatrice to his commanding general in Cambodia in the 1830s, "The barbarians in Cambodia have become my children now, and you should help them and teach them our customs. I have heard, for example, that the land is plentiful and fertile, and that there are plenty of oxen for plowing, but the people have no knowledge of advanced agriculture, using picks and hoes rather than oxen. They grow enough rice for 2 meals a day, but they don't store any surplus. Daily necessities like cloth, silk, ducks, and pork are very expensive. Now all these shortcomings stem from the laziness of the Cambodians, and my instructions to you are these. Teach them to use oxen. Teach them to grow more rice. Teach them to raise mulberry trees, pigs, and ducks. As for language, they should be taught to speak Vietnamese. Our habits of dress and table manners must also be followed. If there is any outdated or barbarous custom that can be simplified or repressed, then do so." But behind the civilizing mission stood colonial force. Dynam mistreatment of Khmer laborers recruited to build the great Vinh Thi Canal in the Mekong Delta in the early 1820s had already led to a brief but violent revolt. Nguyen troops crushed it, but Minh Mang's renewed efforts in the 1830s to transform Cambodians into loyal Dynam subjects sparked revolts among both discontented elites and hungry peasants. When the authorities in Hue moved to do away with Theravada monasteries and suppress the Khmer monarchy altogether, anti-colonial resistance surged, increasingly backed by the Thais. This eventually allowed the Cambodians to regain a fragile Thai and Dynam-backed independence in 1848. The death of Minh Mang in 1841 helped. While the territorial limits of the Nguyen state returned roughly to those of 1802, had the Thais not intervened, the borders of present-day Vietnam and Cambodia would have been very different. Minh Mang's territorial consolidation was not limited to the south, however. A policy no less aggressive occurred in non-Viet areas in the northern highlands of Tuyen Quang, Thai Nguyen, Cao Bang, and Lang Son. Until Minh Mang, Vietnamese emperors had followed the Chinese lead in ruling indirectly over these multi-ethnic borderlands. This system, called Thu Si in Chinese and Tho Ti in Vietnamese, allowed hereditary Thai leaders to continue administering their people and lands in exchange for their loyalty to the Vietnamese Empire, payment of taxes, and support in wartime. In 1829, Minh Mang did away with this hereditary system in favor of one judged more modern and centralized with his state-trained Viet Mandarins at the helm. However, local resistance to this revolutionary change in exercising power was immediate. A local chief, Nong Van Van, led a two-year revolt in 1833-5. Minh Mang's troops would squash it, but the emperor would end up allowing the Nong family to maintain its local leadership. The emperor had no choice. He needed this family's collaboration in order to rule such distant areas of the empire. Direct administration was impossible in these faraway lands, and there were never enough Viet civil servants to be found in Hue who were willing to serve in such an alien environment. The question, however, was whether Minh Mang's successors could keep such audacious internal state-building and aggressive colonial expansion on track at the same time as imperially-minded Europeans were moving deeper into the region, including a resurging France. While Minh Mang's revolution of the 1830s established the administrative foundations of this unprecedented Vietnam, his policies generated anger, divisions, and resistance among elites and their constituencies from the Red River and Mekong deltas deep into Laos and Cambodia. Minh Mang's successors, Thieu Tri and Thieu Duc in particular, never had the time to heal these wounds, which covered so much of the country. And the French would take advantage of this divided Vietnamese house in order to promote their own colonial cause. Vietnamese Catholicism and Minh Mang State-Building Project. The pretext the French would use to justify their attack on the Nguyen in 1858 was the court's persecution of Catholics. However, in 1802, no one could have predicted such a scenario. Ya Long might not have trusted the Catholics and certainly had no intention of becoming one, but his relationship with them was better than any other monarch in Vietnamese history up to that point. Many European missionaries and Viet Christians had helped him to regain his kingdom and unify the country. In exchange, Ya Long accorded them considerable post-war privileges, not least of all the right to practice their religion freely and rebuild their devastated church. The emperor allowed his Catholic advisor during the Tay Son Wars, Bishop Pinyot de Bien, to be buried in Saigon. He delivered a funeral oration praising his friend for all that he had done for the country. Little wonder that European and Vietnamese Catholics continued